Hello, welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. From Flagstaff, I'm your volunteer reader, Deborah McFadder, with selections from Yes Media, a nonprofit independent publisher of solutions journalism. Last time we read together, we were reading a story from a competition that was sponsored by Grist magazine. It's a climate fiction for the future is the theme of these stories. The story we were reading was called Plantains in Heaven by Kenichu Adugu, and it was first published January 17th, 2025. In a short review of the story, this one is set in London, way in the future, after a possible break in the water break around the Thames River, and London has now gone underwater. People are living only on the top floors of very high buildings. The two characters are using their kayak to go back and forth and take care of some plantain plants that they are trying to grow for the girl's grandmother and the young man's mom. As you recall, last week they were going to check on these plants when they were intercepted by a team that was looking to see if anybody was doing anything illegal. And so they began to figure out a way to escape. They threw off the discs around their necks that would measure if they were not getting enough oxygen. And they put on respirators to try to save themselves. Here's what we finished with last time. I had always imagined how it would feel to hug her for the first time. Relief was not one of the emotions I thought would be coursing through my veins, especially with the added realization that Adriana's arms had found their way around my shoulders. On any other day, a heartfelt declaration would have been the only way to seal this moment. That was the respirator. I don't know if the words tumbled out of me, making more sense in my head than out. Thank you for doing that. Adriana leaned back, the fear in her eyes still clear. No, thank you for shutting the discs off. We'd be in bigger trouble if you hadn't done that. I think the fact that you saved my lungs deserves more credit than what I did. I somehow found it in me to chuckle. Technically, you wouldn't be here at all if I hadn't asked for your help, she said. Still, thank you, I said. I reached for her again and didn't let go for a little longer. Adriana didn't pull away, only sighing heavily when I finally sat back. We said no more, keeping the respirators on as we carefully made our way out of the house. The street was empty, as expected, so we turned the corner and headed to our original destination. When we arrived outside the hotel, a fresh red marking on the wall greeted us. Remember, they were growing the plantains inside an abandoned hotel. And as these inspectors would move through the city and check the buildings to see if they were still going to stand or not, they would make a red cross on the building. No, it can't be. The despair in Adriana's voice was almost as stifling as the dust cloud. Hang on, let's see what it says. I pulled out my phone and scanned a black dot by the cross. Limited structural damage detected in basement level walls. I read the summary on my screen. Foundations unaffected, however, structural integrity of the building fabric is likely to deteriorate further within 12 months. My sigh of relief echoed Adriana's. At least it didn't say a month or even two. There was still time for the plantains to reach maturity. Adriana's head snapped my way, her eyes widening. Do you think they... She couldn't get the rest out. We moored the canoe and sprinted up to the ballroom. Thank God, Adriana cried out when we stumbled in to find our investment intact. But we're screwed anyway, I said, walking up to touch one of the broad green leaves. This building's now on their radar. I think it may be a good thing. I raised an eyebrow at her. What part of this would possibly be good? Think about all the houses they inspect on your street. Once they mark them as structurally unsound, they don't bother with them again for a while, do they? We're still risking collapse on ourselves if we stick to this. And when last did you hear of a marked building collapsing? I frowned. She wasn't wrong. If my projection is right, based on the temperatures we've been maintaining, we have about 6 more months to go before we can hope for fruits to show up. Adriana didn't look deterred. In fact, there was a new light in her eyes. All we need is one bunch to make all this worth it. We can still make it happen.
You deserve a medal for all this, you know. I couldn't help smiling this time. I would have given up ages ago, maybe all the way back in that week when we were waiting to hear if the rhizomes were available. And definitely that time the plants started to wilt because you thought we'd overwatered them. But somehow you just keep going.
I thought my compliment would turn her lips up, but she only shrugged. Is it silly that I keep praying this has to work? Because what if there are no plantains in heaven?
Adriana choked back a sob. My hand reached for hers. Adriana looked down at it.
Your abuela will hold on for the right ones right here.
Her answer came after a long pause.
Promise?
When her eyes met mine again, they glistened. We both knew my answer held no meaning, yet I nodded, squeezing her hand gently.
I promise.
This story is part of Imagine 2200, Climate Fiction for Future Ancestors, a climate fiction contest produced by Grist Magazine. Imagine 2200 asked writers to imagine the next 180 years of equitable climate progress, and the winning stories feature intersectional worlds in which no community is left behind. And we will be able to read all 12 stories in the collection. Next, we're in the section Wealth and Inequality. This article was first published on January 10th, 2025, written by Darna Noor. It's entitled, Can Everyone Eat for the Planet? I shopped at Dollar Store for a week to find out. The illustration that accompanies this story has a blue background. There's a large white dinner plate right in the middle of it with a fork on the left side and a knife on the right. Instead of just all being regular food on the plate, though, we can see some peas and beans and what looks like a piece of pork chop or a chicken leg, maybe, some blueberries and tomatoes. There are pieces of dollar bills torn up all over the plate. As a fossil fuels and climate reporter, most of my journalism focuses on the need to radically overhaul the energy system. But the food sector always needs a makeover, as it creates between a quarter and a third of all greenhouse gas emissions. When scientists came up with a new climate-friendly food plan in 2019 and published their findings in the medical journal The Lancet, I read with interest. The guidelines called for more vegetables, legumes, and whole grains, which seemed doable to me. The authors even allowed for meat and dairy consumption, albeit in small quantities. Both are major drivers of the climate crisis. The United Nations estimates that meat and dairy produce more than 11% of all global greenhouse gas emissions, and some experts put the figure at up to 19.6%. But I've long wondered whether the widely respected food plan could work for most Americans. In my hometown of Baltimore, a quarter of all people live in food deserts, a figure some researchers say is an underestimate. Nationally, grocery stores have shuttered left and right in recent years. Increasingly, many Americans are relying on a very particular kind of shop for food, dollar stores, which are the fastest-growing retailers in the U.S. In Baltimore, there are dozens. Those factors dictate how sustainable and nourishing individual diets can be. Our food choices are largely shaped by the food environment around us, including which foods are available, affordable, convenient, and desirable, said Rachel Cento, a Baltimore-based senior food and climate research associate at the nonprofit World Resources Institute. Everyone deserves the opportunity to enjoy healthy, sustainable meals that nourish both people and the planet. Can dollar stores provide Americans with that opportunity? I decided to find out. For 1 week, I attempted to follow the Lancet Planetary Health Diet while grocery shopping at them exclusively. The experience left me feeling dejected and bloated. The dollar store. Other people have created extensive spreadsheets and meal plans for their forays into the planetary health diet. I've never been a planner. To guide my grocery shopping, I merely typed the basic tenets of the food plan into my phone's notes app. 34% of calories, from starches like rice and wheat, 23% from legumes, 18% from fats, 8% from fruits and vegetables, the remaining 10% from dairy, meat, and sugar. I planned to head to the store after my first meeting, but got busy until mid-afternoon. When I reached Dollar Tree, I quickly filled a cart with beans, tortillas, pre-cooked brown rice, oatmeal, peanut butter, and other staples. I was in desperate need of vegetables, but the options were highly limited. I sighed as I placed some canned ones in my cart. In the checkout aisle, I saw a can of Pringles chips. Having skipped breakfast, I was starving, so I impulsively added them to my haul and ate them on the drive home. Hours later, I realized I'd made a mistake. The diet encourages limiting consumption of both starchy vegetables and saturated oils, which are both surprisingly emissions-intensive to produce, and I'd gone over my daily allotment of the latter. I resolved to be more careful. For a proper lunch, I heated some brown rice and whipped up black beans from a can, which were more expensive than the ones I buy from my usual grocery store. As luck would have it, my can opener broke, so I was forced to hack open a can of corn with a knife. I ate my austere lunch with little pleasure. For dinner, I had leftovers with half a slice of tinny-tasting cheese. I desperately wanted to add some fresh produce to my meal, but the Dollar General had none. When I sat down to analyze my day's meals, I realized I was way behind on my fruit and vegetable intake, since the Lancet authors classify corn as a starch. I quickly stir-fried some tinned green beans with salt and pepper. They were awful. You are tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona, listening to excerpts from Yes Media. Before we continue, I'd like to remind you that you can get our stream and on-demand programs with our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. Back to our article about eating from the dollar store. Breaking the rules. I woke up the next morning and realized something would have to change. I'd prepared my first day's food with only ingredients from Dollar General, but since the Lancet study doesn't address spices, I decided using seasonings from my cabinet would be okay. This helped, but new problems arose. I'd planned to eat liberal scoops of peanut butter each morning since the diet calls for a high intake of legume, but the brand I'd purchased had added sugar, which is discouraged in the climate diet since it's surprisingly land, water, and carbon intensive to produce and linked to health issues like diabetes. So I had to instead rely on salted peanuts. The tortillas I'd purchased also had a surprising amount of added sugar, as did the mandarin orange fruit cups and tins of pineapple I'd bought in a desperate attempt to integrate fruit into my diet. For the next couple of days, I stuck to brown rice and corn to meet my starch intake and rinsed the fruit off thoroughly before eating it. Experts say eating a wide variety of fruits and vegetables is beneficial for gut health, but I quickly realized that wouldn't be an option since the dollar store doesn't offer much variety when it comes to plants. In search of produce. When I began my experiment, I resolved not to eat out for the week. I figured it would betray the spirit of the project to go to restaurants as much as it pained me to refuse a friend's invitation to grab pizza. But on night three, I caved. At a work event, I munched on a handful of cherry tomatoes and carrot sticks. Climate diet-friendly foods, sure, but ones that surely didn't come from a dollar store. Those bites of crudité left me fiending for more fresh food. Dollar General has since last year been adding produce to more of their stores, so the following morning I called around to find one. Soon I found a location that offered fruits and vegetables, a 15-minute drive away. I was excited by the prospect of a salad, but I felt ridiculous. That week I'd already driven to my closest Dollar Tree, and now I was going to have to drive even more. Using an online carbon calculator, I learned that my round-trip drive could generate up to 5 pounds of planet-warming carbon dioxide, meaning it could be more emissions-heavy than a 3-ounce steak. I started to spiral. I'm no believer in emphasizing the personal carbon footprint, and yet I'd taken on this project, but I pushed these thoughts aside as I drove. Slim pickings. The Dollar Tree produce pickings were slim. Browning bananas, bags of potatoes and onions, and some uninspiring pre-made salads. The cherry tomatoes were starting to mold. The mushrooms were covered in soft, dark spots. The iceberg lettuce looked okay, but the more nutritious romaine was wilting and twice as expensive. The plastic-wrapped bell peppers were in the best shape, so I felt I had to grab some, even though they're my least favorite vegetable. I reluctantly placed a sad-looking selection of produce into my cart, then went in search of other groceries. This time I was equipped with a more extensive list. But many of my desired items were nowhere to be found. There were no lentils, no whole grains other than rice, and no loaves of bread, tortillas, or yogurt that didn't have added sugar. I had also hoped to find some climate diet-friendly frozen meals, but save for the bags of fries, every single option contained meat, cheese, or both. I went home and cooked some black beans for the second time that week, adding peppers, tomatoes, and a whole onion. I ate my stew over brown rice with a whole head of romaine lettuce. It would have to do. Off the rails. The following day, I had oatmeal with bananas and strawberries for breakfast, and more rice, beans, and salad for lunch. But that evening, things went off the rails. It was the weekend, and I had family in town, so I decided to break the rules to show them my favorite local oyster bar. When we placed our order, I thought all bets were off for my meal plan. But as it turned out, I didn't fare so badly. The oysters were allowed, and even the half a burger I had fell within my red meat allotment. I ate some much-needed Brussels sprouts, beets, and nuts. And since the diet didn't mention drinks, I suppose even my martini, fine, two martinis, was all right. But nothing I ate that night could have come from the dollar store. In fact, my dinner cost more than all my other meals that week combined. While eating some dollar store popcorn later that night, a whole grain, so diet-friendly, I perused the menus of the cheaper local restaurants I frequent. They invariably offered meat, cheese, sugar, heavy fare. In the final days of my experiment, I tried to use up all of my dollar store purchases, but some of my produce spoiled quickly. I'd unintentionally contributed to an issue the Lancet authors highlighted. Food waste is a major contributor to climate warming emissions, and the authors say it should be cut by half. On my final food plan day, I noticed a purple head of local radicchio in my crisper drawer, which I'd bought at the health food store the previous week. I was fresh out of dollar store vegetables and didn't want it to spoil. Plus, I was sick of beans and rice, so I cheated and ate the whole thing with lemon juice and olive oil. Targeted policy to expand food access, experts have pointed out, will be necessary for the Lancet Climate Food Plan to become effective. Amid research showing that many people lack access to nutritious meals, advocates are pushing for dollar stores to stock fresher, more desirable, healthy foods. That could help improve people's overall well-being, and it could also improve the health of the planet. But dollar stores alone aren't the problem, so they can't be the only focus of the solution. The broader food system must change to ensure people can eat sustainably. Increasing access to a variety of plant-based foods and the presence of these options at stores and other food providers is the first step, said Santo. Other factors, including the cost, quality, convenience of preparation, variety, and cultural relevance, are also key to shaping a food environment that enables healthy and sustainable food choices. In the meantime, I'll no longer take my ability to access and afford a variety of food for granted. That goes for fruits, vegetables, legumes, and whole grains. But now that I'm off the climate diet, I might also eat another can of Pringles. This story is part of an ongoing series of reporting on a just and climate-friendly food system produced in collaboration with The Guardian, Nexus Media News, Sentient, and Yes Magazine, with funding from the Solutions Journalism Network, advisory support from Garrett Board, Rowan University, and audience engagement through Project Drawdown's Global Solutions Diary. About the author. Darna Noor is a staff writer at Earther, whose writing has appeared in Truthout, Jacobin, and the Baltimore Beat. Our finish today will be the opinion column, In Fighting Fascism, We Must Choose Our Battles Wisely, by William C. Anderson, first published January 24, 2025. A photograph at the beginning shows the State Street in Chicago filled with people carrying signs in protest of new developments that have happened this week of January 20th. The start of 2025 has been unsurprisingly chaotic, as a surge of wildfires engulfed the Los Angeles area, stealing people's homes and livelihoods. The news broke that the world's lands and oceans recorded the hottest year on record in 2024. Even before his inauguration this week, President Donald Trump floated invading Greenland, retaking the Panama Canal, and making Canada the 51st state, while pointing his America First policies toward expansionism and imperialist ends. He threatened the entire Middle East, justifying Israel's ongoing genocide in Gaza. He also sought a public health justification for shuttering the southern border, much like the racist U.S. gassing policies that once inspired the Nazis. Since being sworn in, Trump acted on many of his statements immediately and signed a flurry of executive orders, redefining birthright citizenship and gender, as well as reversing climate regulations, among other terrible things. These issues alone paint just a portion of the picture of what's coming to those of us who plan to fight back. The truth of these moments and many others is that if we plan to defy the order of the day, we must decide between what's worth fighting about and what's not the best use of our time. Often the fights we choose to take up may not reflect the urgency other issues demand. Those emergencies can become so great that they choose us when we can no longer deny the need for our full participation. Now is the time to commit ourselves rather than wait to be forced into action by circumstances. This is the difference between proactively planning instead of waiting to see what happens and reacting to it. Resistance based on reaction may operate from the point of disadvantage if it usually requires an antagonism or a spark to mobilize a response. So we're forced to admit that we have priorities if we understand this and then decide what to do about them. Some fights are over issues that concern life and death, while others may be about much more trivial things. Internalizing awareness here will provide needed wisdom and precision about what makes the best use of our time during compounding crises. The nonstop news cycle, personal conflict, and the weight of survival make it hard to figure out where to focus our energy. However, as recent years have shown, it's of the utmost importance to figure this out so that we don't exhaust ourselves from pointless ventures. The political moment we're in, where fascism is wearing us down, demands intentionality that should disrupt nonsense. Therefore, if we find ourselves amid unserious squabbles, it's a testament to the unseriousness of the parties who choose to remain entangled. It's not that we cannot multitask and focus on multiple issues simultaneously, or that we should use dismissiveness to avoid accountability by labeling it a distraction. It's that an unending circus of self-centeredness, celebrity drama, and political theater disrupts our focus and degrades our perspective. Unimportant fights are disagreements like those that center the famous and influencers as representative people attach themselves to. They're the conflicts that become inundated with pitfalls of disempowering political representation. That's how the public ends up arguing for politicians who don't care about them and stars who don't share their class interests. This means that people must overcome the draw to participate in celebrity worship, symbolic issues, and other quarrels like the petty ideological struggles black anarchist Martin Sostry once spoke about. He said we have to look at the substance, and that's what always missing from so much of the messiness capitalist culture inundates us with. If more of us had genuine deep relationships, too, many of the insignificant spats among us might subside. We can have our differences and even dislike one another while recognizing the gravity of this time we're trying to survive. Skipping ahead a little bit, siloed, powerless people fighting over who gets the most influence, while those with actual power pummel them all, is undoubtedly a goofy scene. This reality may overshadow another one of the statements made by Jackson. Each popular struggle must be analyzed historically to discover new ideas. Bitter unity isn't the answer. It's often disastrous, too, but we have to answer something. Who is fed, housed, given health care, safety, and security
by what we're fighting about? Does the fight we're in lead to a change that can alter people's lives for the better or advance us toward a revolutionary shift? What are the most important fights then? That may depend on where you're at and what the conditions say at a given moment. Someone fighting an actual fight knows that putting out the flames around them supersedes everything else at the time. Nonsensical, repetitive debates on social media and posturing keep tiring us out. We need as much energy as possible to challenge the dominant status quo. It's one of the main reasons we have to be able to differentiate between disputes that happen for dispute's sake or because people or entities around us want to create problems. A feeling of hopelessness and powerlessness has already begun to surface, but that particular feeling can easily be overcome. Not only must our analyses show our accomplishments, they must also show our failures and mistakes. The oppressive elements we know all too well may not be as strong as we imagine. Teen hackers have made breaching federal authorities into child's play. We saw this tyrannical president hide in a bunker when we rose against state violence in response to the killing of George Floyd. Even now, we've seen that a lone gunman with something to prove has sent shockwaves throughout the ruling elite. These aren't distant memories. These things all tell us a lot about what's possible in today's world. A call to focus and concentrate our efforts is not necessarily a plea for centralization. Instead, it's about being led by what the world around us is showing us our primary concerns should be. Sometimes the stakes are so high, it's not even a question or a debate. It's an immediate action that happens without question. You're supposed to duck when someone throws a punch, but if you're too preoccupied, the blow will hurt that much worse. We can look around and see who's hitting us and who wants to knock us out of the frame completely. Instead of waiting for them to swing on us again, let's evolve and hit them first. This story was originally published in Prism. At the end of our time, you have been listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, to excerpts from Yes Media. From Flagstaff, I'm your volunteer reader, Deborah McFadder. Thanks a lot for listening.